Good morning. I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak to you today. I'd like to thank Nina and the other conference organizers for making this possible for me to be here for the invitation. I'd like to start this morning with a story that I heard a couple years ago. There's a radio program in the United States on the National Public Radio called This American Life. This story comes from Alex Bloomberg, who's actually an executive producer of the program. So I'd like to play you a quick clip from this radio program that I heard a few years back that will kind of introduce my topic today.
I can reconstruct the events that led me to one of the most embarrassing conversations of my adult life. The chain starts back when I was 11 or 12, and I first heard the term Nielsen family. I was probably listening to some adults talk, and from their conversation I gathered that networks consulted Nielsen families to find out how popular a television show was. But that didn't make sense. Why would they only ask people named Nielsen which shows they liked? I started thinking. I knew that when they figured things like this out, they didn't ask everybody, they just asked a small percentage of people and then extrapolated. I think I figured they'd done some research and found that the name Nielsen, because it was a common name maybe, and it seemed to cut across class and economic lines, actually came pretty close to a representative sample. I knew this wasn't the way they measured public opinion now, but it seemed like the Nielsen surveys had been around for a while, and I figured they were just a holdover from a more primitive, less statistically rigorous time. After that, I really didn't think about it again. Or if I did, it was only with a mild curiosity. I wonder why TV still does it that way. Fast forward 20 years. I was talking with a friend of mine who was telling me about her friend who'd been selected to be a Nielsen family. And I said to her, "Isn't it weird that they're all named Nielsen?" My friend looked at me for what seemed like a long time. Somewhere during her very long pause, because of the very long pause, in fact, I realized, of course they're not all named Nielsen. That makes no sense at all. At the time of this conversation, I was 34 years old, and I couldn't believe I'd gotten this far without ever stopping to think it through. It made me wonder what else I'd missed, and if this has ever happened to anyone besides me.
So Alex's experience here was he made a set of faulty assumptions about the Nielsen family surveys. And it's not, they're not really all named Nielsen. And it took him 20 years to figure this out. And I share this story for two reasons. One is that I find myself doing this all the time. I'm always making assumptions and I don't realize until later how faulty they are. The second reason is I think that some assumptions that librarians have made over the years are perhaps faulty assumptions. They were true at one point, but maybe no longer are true. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit. And I'd like to start off by summarizing a keynote presentation that I heard a few years ago in the 2008 North American Cereals Interest Group. There was a keynote speaker by the name of Mike Kuniowski, and he gave a presentation about ubiquitous computing that I thought was just fascinating. And if ubiquitous computing is something you're not familiar with, I suggest you take a look at it. And it's really fascinating. I'll give a quick summary of it here today. I'm going to be giving, for the next 4 or 5 minutes, a summary of this. It's going to be about 3/4 summary and about 1/4 my interpretation of what he actually said. He started off by analogizing the world of computers to the world of electric motors. So back at the turn of the 20th century, electric motors were very expensive items. You bought one motor for the house, and then you just bought attachments for it. Electric motors were too expensive to buy a motor for everything that you needed. So if you wanted an electric fan because you were hot, you'd buy an attachment for the motor and stick it on there. If you wanted your motor to wash your clothes instead of buying a washing machine, you bought an attachment to wash your clothes on this motor. The motor was essentially a general purpose tool, and it was adapted as needed. As motors got cheaper, however, you started having multiple motors in the home. Instead of an attachment for a fan, you actually bought a fan, you bought a washing machine, you bought a heater, you bought the things that you needed, and they all had their own individual motors. And you ended up with these hyper-specialized motors. And today we see that in a lot of areas. The average car, for example, has 20 to 30 motors in it, which I didn't realize. That's a lot of motors. These motors really led to a lot of unintended consequences. One of those consequences was, which I found fascinating, was wall-to-wall carpeting. So before the advent of the vacuum and the electric motor, wall-to-wall carpeting was unheard of. It was just simply too expensive. You maybe had a rug, but it cost so much to have that rug cleaned and to maintain that only the super rich could afford to have something like that. However, with the vacuum, you could get wall-to-wall carpeting, and it's just a really interesting consequence of electric motors. And Mr. Kuniowski then said that we see the same thing happening today with computers as what happened with the electric motor at the turn of the century. We're essentially in the third age of computing. The first age was the age of the mainframe. You had one big computer that lots of people shared and used that one computer. The second age of computing was the desktop computer, where one person had one computer sitting on their desk that they could use. Now we're living in the age of ubiquitous computing. You likely have a computer sitting on your desk at work. You probably have one at home. You might even have one in your pocket. Smartphones are essentially computers these days. So ubiquitous computing is where one person uses multiple computers. And just like electric motors, the hyper-specialization of electric motors led to unintended consequences, so has and so will ubiquitous computing. The phrase ubiquitous computing was actually coined in 1988 by Mark Weiser. And he describes ubiquitous computing as follows. He says that the most profound technologies are those that disappear. They weave themselves into the fabric of everyday life until they are indistinguishable from it. And then continuing on with this thought of ubiquitous computing, what are the consequences? What are some of those interesting consequences I've been talking about? Mike Kuniowski describes it as follows. He says, ubiquitous computing gives us tools to track, trade, and share objects much more efficiently than any previous technology. So we can track, trade, and share objects. So what does this mean in real terms? Just a few examples that you may have heard of, and I apologize if some of these examples are U.S.-centric, but I think you'll get the idea of some of the consequences here. One is the service called Netflix. This is a service, you may have heard about it. You go online, you sign up for the service, and they mail you DVDs at no charge. As part of your subscription, they mail you DVDs. You can watch the movies that you want at your leisure, and then send them back at no charge. But not only that, you get DVDs, but you can also stream the videos straight to your computer or to your TV. This model is really changing the way that we think about ownership of movies. I mean, for me, I don't watch tons of movies, I don't own tons of movies, but why would I ever want to own a movie if I could pay a very small fee to Netflix and just watch a movie anytime I want? Instead of just having access to a very small library sitting on my shelf at home, I have access to hundreds of thousands of movies in this database on Netflix's site. So ownership isn't just about owning the object anymore. Access is many times good enough. And it's only since the advent of ubiquitous computing that something like this has become possible. Before, it was impossible to track this type of thing, to monetize this type of model. But with the network and with computers, it's much easier to do. Here's another example. There's a service in the U.S. called Zipcar. I know that there are very many services similar to this in Europe. I believe Paris has one that uses the same system except with bicycles. Basically, Zipcar is a service that instead of owning a car, if you need to get around town, you hop online or you pull out your smartphone, and you look up where the nearest car is to your location using GPS. And it tells you, okay, there's a car one block from you. You can walk there. You can actually use your phone to open the car and drive wherever you need to. You can reserve the car online, drive it, bring it back, and turn it back in. So instead of owning the car, you own the right to use the car. That's a very different idea of ownership. Instead of owning the car, you own the right to use the car. Of course, the idea of subscribing to something instead of owning it is nothing new to librarians. We've been working with serials for many years, and more specifically with aggregators and databases, where we subscribe to the content, we don't necessarily own it. However, with the advent of ubiquitous computing, the possibilities for what we can have access to without having ownership are almost endless. Just a few years ago, this was not even financially feasible. But today, we can go and pay a database vendor a small fee, and they give us access to a full-text database. And sometimes the full-text in that database is essentially equivalent to a print library. So just with the flip of a switch, you can get access to entire libraries' worth of information in a lot of cases. In the past, the words access and ownership were synonymous in the library world. Those two terms were inextricably intertwined. If you wanted to give access to content to your users, they had to come to your library, they had to come to your card catalog, they had to look up the item, they had to get it off of your shelf. That was the only way to provide access, is to have ownership of the item. Interlibrary loan changed this to a small degree, but it's only been since the advent of ubiquitous computing, and the network specifically, that access and ownership have been truly decoupled. And going back to Alex Bloomberg and his assumptions about the Nielsen families, the biggest assumption that librarians are now questioning is that we must own content in order to provide research quality resources. So just how far will this idea go of access instead of ownership? How many resources are really so critical to our mission as libraries that we must own them? Certainly there are a number of things that we must own, but the greater majority, do we have to own them? Or is access good enough for what we are doing? In other words, the big question is ownership versus access. And there's no one-size-fits-all answer to this question. However, I believe that in the future, access rather than ownership is the best answer for many cases. Finding the optimal mix is the right answer. It all depends on where we're willing to see dotted lines in our world. So I don't think I fully explained the dotted line idea, but Mike Kuniowski described it as, because of ubiquitous computing, we live in a world where everything has a dotted line around it. We have access to things, but we don't have to own it. Everything's just kind of there, and it's filled in by the network. So I've dubbed this phenomenon Kuniowski's Law. It's just something I made up. And basically, I state it as follows, that ubiquitous computing has permanently decoupled access and ownership. The second principle I'd like to talk about today is that of access and discoverability. We've talked about access and ownership, but now access and discoverability is what I'd like to talk about. And an example of this is the music industry, and more specifically, the record and the record player. So we already discussed how electric motors became hyper-specialized. One of the hyper-specialized uses of an electric motor was the turntable record player. The turntable allowed for playback of recorded music, speeches, and other orally communicated content. However, if you wanted to get access to a specific song or a specific item on the record, you had to know exactly where to place that tiny little needle at the end of the record player. Some of you may remember doing that. In other words, the content was accessible, but it was not very easily discoverable. Other technologies in the music industry came and went, but they were still, discovery was still not very good. Then along came the compact disc player. The discs were broken down into tracks, allowed for quick access and quick discovery of the content. Discovery has increased significantly with the advent of services such as iTunes. There are other services. There's Pandora, which I believe is US-centric, but then there are others like Last.fm, Django, and others that allow for streaming of music. Not only that, they provide recommendations of music based on your past music consumption, which opens up whole new doors of discovering new music. So this discovery is really opened up in the last few years. And I'd like to suggest that libraries are following along a similar path to the music as the music industry. Before the advent of the network, and specifically before the online library catalog, discovery systems were extremely tedious. To find anything, you had to scour the library card catalog system. And at the risk of ruining any credibility I may have already lended myself, I'll tell you that I had a very hard time using the card catalog system. I was not very good at this. This was too hard for me. I never grasped this as a kid growing up using this. It was very difficult. Fortunately, I came into librarianship at a time when most libraries have already switched over to an online system. I'm very good at using those systems, so I still have a job. So from the card catalog, we then moved into the age of the network. It came along, we opened up many opportunities for improving discovery of library collections. WorldCat was created. It co-located many library collections and made discovering the nearest location with access very simple. But WorldCat was the equivalent of the compact disc. It revolutionized discovery, but it was still largely an analog tool. So the discovery was digital, but the access was still analog. You could find content, but then you still had to go to a library, pick something off a shelf, and then get it. I'd like to suggest that Google Scholar is to libraries what iTunes and other such services were to the music industry. It streamlined both discovery and access to our library collections. It integrates with WorldCat, so it knows what is available in our print collections. And if you use your Link Resolver or other such tools, you can give Google access to what you have in your electronic collections as well. I call this Google Scholar's Law. So Kuniyovsky's Law stated that ubiquitous computing decoupled access and ownership. Google Scholar's Law, I say, decoupled access and discovery. So if computers are doing all of this work for us, where does this leave libraries? What is our role? My contention today is that libraries are here to provide access to our patrons, to the content, in the best format for them. Discovery is perhaps best left to services such as Google and Google Scholar, the network at large. Libraries, however, have always been very good at finding the best content. And our role, I believe, in the future is to continue to provide that access and leave the discovery to others that already seem to have the advantage. So I'd like to talk a little bit today about some research that some colleagues and I have been working on with Google Scholar. We saw these things going on with Google Scholar. We thought it was a very interesting area and wanted to take a closer look at it and find out, okay, if discovery is best left to Google Scholar, is Google Scholar really a good tool for discovery? Or are there some problems with it? We were at the outset very skeptical about Google Scholar, and so we wanted to take a closer look. Specifically, we wanted to know how the results from Google Scholar compared to the results that you would get from a typical library database. In other words, which is the better discovery tool, library databases or Google Scholar? As you might imagine, when Google Scholar was first introduced, there was a significant amount of skepticism in the library world. Many did not want to acknowledge that Google Scholar might have an important role to play in any librarian's toolbox. And so it might be helpful here to give a little bit of history about Google Scholar. Before Google, there were a whole host of search engines available to the average internet user. This is what the internet looked like around the time that Google was introduced to the public in 2008. Many of you may recognize some of these. Just out of curiosity, how many of you still use one or more of these services? No one? How many of you use Google? All right, so virtually everyone. That's really quite interesting. If you look at the market research, it shows that Google only has about they have 65% of the market, which means about 65% of the general public only go to Google when they're looking for things online. in a search engine. So actually, librarians are different from the average. Most librarians just use Google, at least in this crowd, which is, that's quite interesting. Most of these search engines are gone now. They've been eaten by the Google monster, basically. Many of these are owned now. The ones that are still around are driven by others. There are virtually only three search engines out there. There's Google, there's Yahoo, and then Microsoft has MSN, Live Search, Bing, whatever they call it now. They've changed the name so many times. There are others, but AltaVista, for instance, is still around, but it uses Yahoo's search engine. I think Ask Jeeves might still be around, but I think it's using another one as well. There's been a lot of consolidation in the search engine market. So here's what Google looked like when it first came out in 1998. You'll notice that they are bragging about having 25 million pages in their index. The last time they released numbers on this was back in 2005, so about 5 years ago. They had over 25 billion pages. So when they say that 25 million pages soon to be much bigger, I don't think they realized how big they were actually going to get in the end. But that was 5 years ago. They're much, much, much bigger now, but they don't release those kinds of numbers anymore. So by the time that Google Scholar was introduced at the end of 2004, Google had lots of search experience. They'd been doing this for a long time. They knew what they were doing. But more importantly, they had discovery experience. Despite all of this, there was still a lot of skepticism, especially from the library world, about Google Scholar. However, there were a few libraries that I know of in the US and perhaps around the world where research institutions began placing Google Scholar on their home pages. They were just testing it out. There were many articles that were published about Google Scholar that I want to talk a little bit about. Some of the better and the more comprehensive articles were written by Peter Jasko, who's from the University of Hawaii. He described Google Scholar's search results with such glowing terms as shallowness and, my personal favorite, artificial unintelligence. There were other studies that tried to match citations hit to hit. These studies were conducted by Newhouse, Brophy, Bowden, and a number of others out there. Basically, matching citations hit to hit meant that they went out and they gathered a large data set, typically from a respectable database that was already out there. For example, ISI's Web of Science, or Scopus. They'd go to these different databases, they'd gather the full content, they'd work with these vendors to get everything that was available from these database vendors, and then they would go through one by one and see if those citations were available in Google Scholar. And what these studies found was the obvious. There are a lot of holes in Google Scholar. There were some problems there. But this is because Google Scholar indexes from a number of reputable sources. So the reason for the holes, they get information from publishers' websites when they're given permission to do so. But they also get information from professors' personal websites. They get information from anything basically in the .edu domain. They get information from institutional repositories. And the nature of those last three resources are such that things are going to have holes. But the nature of those resources also suggests that Google's able to use those sources to better identify the seminal papers in a particular discipline. They're able to identify the prominent authors in a discipline much more readily, much more easily than what you're able to do with a typical library database. So after the initial onslaught of negative reviews, authors began looking at some of the value-added services that Google Scholar made available. Some of these included tracking open access content in institutional repositories. This line of research was conducted by Kosha, Thelwell, and many others. More recently, Peter Jasko, just this past summer, released yet another article about Google Scholar. where he acknowledged that Google Scholar has improved significantly since his initial set of studies. He no longer describes it as artificial unintelligence. He's starting to see that there's some value there. But he then goes on to talk about some other problems with the citation counts and other small, relatively small quibbles about Google Scholar as a service. The research that we undertook, myself and my colleagues undertook, was a very different approach than this other type of research that I've been talking about. This other research took a look at the inputs into Google Scholar and wanted to know how much quality was there. We wanted to take a look at the outcomes of a Google Scholar search. We wanted to know if the outcomes of a Google Scholar search were as scholarly or more scholarly, perhaps, than a library database. Specifically, we wanted to know if the Google Scholar results were more or less scholarly, and we did this by directly comparing search results from Google Scholar to search results from library databases. So I want to talk a little bit about the methodology that we used during the study. I'll talk a little bit about the formulas we used, the statistical analysis, and then I'll talk a little bit about the results that we got. The first thing we did in the study is we solicited the help of 7 subject specialists from 3 different disciplines. 3 librarians from the sciences, 2 from the humanities, and 2 from the social sciences. They were all blind to the purpose of the study. They had no idea that we were looking at a study of Google Scholar. They just knew that they needed to help us. Then we asked them to provide us 3 things. So the first thing we asked them to give us was a query that they would typically receive from an undergraduate student. We're primarily an undergraduate institution. So here is an example of a question that we received from the librarian. This is, how does the acquisition and use of a second language in children affect their general cognitive development? Most patrons don't come to us with questions like this, but after a reference interview and we're talking with them, this is the question that we basically end up with. So this is an example from the humanities. So that's the first thing that we got from them, was a question that they would typically receive. The second thing we requested that they give us is a structured query that they would use to actually search a library database. So here's what that previous question looks like when you put it into a database with the Boolean searching and all the fancy stuff that we're used to as librarians. So that's the second thing that they provided us. The third thing we asked them to provide us was the library database that they would use if they were going to go in and search for this topic. So in this case, the librarian said that they would use a database we have called Linguistic and Language Behavior Abstracts. So those are the 3 things that we got from the subject librarians. This is basically what it looked like. You probably can't read it all, but this is the input we got from all 7 librarians. Those are the database queries and what database they would use to search for that type of information. So then we took this information and we used it in 2 different ways. The first was to take the query that they gave us and search the library database that they gave us and get the results. So this is what it looks like. This is Linguistics and Language Behavior Abstracts. We put in the query exactly as they gave it. You can kind of see that up at the top. And then those are the results that we received from the database. We took the first 30 citations from each database. And the reason we selected 30 was because of usability studies. Usability studies say that less than 1% of users ever go beyond the 3rd page of results. And most of our databases return 10 results per page. So 30 results basically represents what over 99% of our users will ever see when they perform a database search. So that's why we did 30. So we ran that search. We got the 30 results from the database. Then we translated that query into something that Google Scholar could understand. So Google Scholar has some Boolean and some search capabilities, that allowed us to put the search in there, and then we got the first 30 results from Google Scholar and got those citations. We put all of the citations from the 30 from the database and the 30 from Google Scholar into a bibliographic management system. We use RefWorks. We put it in there so that you couldn't tell. It basically anonymized the data, essentially. It put all of the citations into a similar format, so they couldn't tell if it came from a database or if it came from Google Scholar. We also saved all of the full text associated with these 30 citations. So if we didn't have the full text, we'd go out to Interlibrary Loan and get it. We just made sure we had all of the full text so that when we went back to the librarians, they didn't have to look anything up. So that's the first way that we use their search query. And here's where it gets a little convoluted. Maybe not convoluted, but it's a little confusing if you're not sure what we're doing. So I'm going to try and explain this the best way that I can. But I've given this presentation a number of times, and this is where most of the questions come up. So I'll try and walk you through this. So we first ran the search in the databases in the Google Scholar for the query that was given to us. Then the second step was to take the citations that we got from the database to see if those 30 citations from the database were available in Google Scholar. So that's a very similar idea to what Newhouse and others were doing when they were comparing things. We were doing it for a different reason that I'll show you in just a second. So let me give you a concrete example here. This is the screenshot that we saw just a minute ago from Linguistic and Language Behavior Abstracts. This is the very first result that we received, the universality of symbolic representation for reading in Asian and alphabetic languages. So we wanted to find out, is that citation, that specific citation, available in Google Scholar? So we basically did a search for that citation, and we find, yes, in fact, it is available in Google Scholar. It's the very first result, in fact. It's there, so we can find it. So we took those, and we did that for all 30 citations in the database. We ran that search in Google Scholar. And then for that 30 searches that we did in Google Scholar, those 30 citations we got previously, we also wanted to find out if those citations in Google Scholar were available in the library databases. So this allowed us to basically create this Venn diagram. So we had 60 results total, and some of them were available only in Google Scholar. So if you run a search in Google Scholar, there's some unique content there. Some of them are available only in the library databases, and so there's unique content there. And then, of course, there's some overlap. That's the middle section of this Venn diagram, where the citations are available in both Google Scholar and the library database. So this allowed us to create a measurement that we called exclusivity. So how exclusively was a citation available? Was it only in Google, was it only in databases, or was it in both? So those were the three options there. So I'll talk a little bit more about exclusivity in a minute. So then, for those 60 citations, we got the 30 from Google Scholar, 30 from the databases. We wanted the librarians to then grade those citations for us. We used the Bibliographic Manager to generate a list of references that we then input into an Excel spreadsheet. And then using a random number table, we basically randomized the results. So the first one could be from Google Scholar, it could be from a database. The librarians, and even I without the key, would have no idea where the citations came from. So we put this into an Excel spreadsheet. You probably can't read it, but that's essentially what it looked like. And then we created these hyperlinks off to the side here. So like I said, we grabbed all of the full text. So we basically delivered two back to the subject librarians. We gave them a CD-ROM with this spreadsheet on it. They could take a look at that first citation, and they could click on that citation number, and then the full text would pull up for them. So they didn't have to go and do any searching. They had 60 citations that we needed them to grade. It was all available to them. They had it on a CD-ROM. And we used this rubric, which is impossible for even me to read up here. But basically, there were six areas that we needed them to take a look at. The first, this is a rubric based on research done by Alexander. There's a book written in 1999 called Web Wisdom, How to Evaluate and Create Information Quality on the Web. And there she describes a rubric that's commonly used for evaluating print resources, but it's been adapted for internet resources. So we asked the subject librarians to assign a score of between 1 and 3 to each of these six categories for each citation. So it's hard to see, but that very first line of the spreadsheet is one citation. And then for each citation, we wanted to know how accurate was that citation. Is it reliable? Was it fact-checked? Was it written or published in a peer-reviewed journal? Was it a good source? The authority also looked at some similar things, the author's qualifications, if it was from a reputable publisher. We wanted to know how objective was this study. Was this a lung cancer study sponsored by Winston or Marlboro or something? Did a cigarette company sponsor this research, or was this sponsored by a National Institute of Health study, or where did this come from? We wanted to know how current was the information. Currency is obviously very important for the sciences, less important for the humanities perhaps, but that was an important factor in this study. We also wanted to know coverage. How deep was the coverage? Was this just a brief summary article about the topic, or was this a really in-depth technical article? And finally, we needed to know how relevant was this article. Theoretically, an article could really be all of those things, get really high marks and all these others, but not be very relevant to the search that was conducted. So we needed to make sure that this was a relevant article. So for this first article, we asked them to give the article a score on accuracy of between 1 and 3. So 1 was below average, 2 was average, and 3 was above average. So essentially what that means is that the perfect article for a search term would receive a score of 18. And we called this the scholarliness score. The worst article that you could possibly have about a topic would receive a score of 6. So basically we had a range of between 6 and 18 as a scholarliness score for these articles. So they graded all of the citations, gave them a grade for all 60 of the citations. And then once they returned that to us, we used this statistical model. You don't need to understand any of this, fortunately. I barely understand it all. We had a statistical expert help us with this portion. But essentially, this formula allowed us to do 2 things. One, it allowed for us to control for the differences between the ways that librarians grade. So one librarian may be a very easy grader and may have given all of the articles a really high mark, whereas another librarian may have had a really bad day and was just cranky and was giving everything really low marks. And so we had to be able to adjust for those differences statistically. So this formula allowed us to do that. The second thing is it allowed for us to control for the differences in how exclusively the citation was available. Essentially what this means is that it allowed us to pinpoint and measure any differences there may have been between disciplines. So that was another one of the criticisms against Google Scholar, was it was really, really good at science, technology, and medicine, and physics, and other science-y type things, but it was really bad at humanities things, was one of the criticisms. We wanted to find out if that was really true. So what did we find? This is where things got really interesting for us. What we found was that citations that were only available in Google Scholar were 17.6% higher on the scholarliness score than citations found only in the library databases. However, the highest scholarliness score was available when a citation was available in both Google Scholar and the library databases. So if you remember that Venn diagram, the highest scores were for those that were in that middle portion of that Venn diagram, which makes sense to us. This is what we expected to find, because if you find a citation in both a library database and in Google Scholar, it's probably a pretty important resource, and it's probably going to rank higher on a scholarliness score. So this worked out pretty well with what we were expecting to find. The other thing that we found was that there was no statistically significant differences in the scholarliness scores between disciplines. So humanities citations in Google Scholar were just as scholarly as the science citations that you would find in Google Scholar. So this is what it looks like when you graph it out. You can see the differences there between disciplines, but this very first section here, those first three bars, is the overall average. So the first one was for the citations found only in the database, which was the right-hand side, far right-hand side of the Venn diagram. The average scholarliness score was 11.9 out of 18. This blue bar are for the citations found only in Google Scholar, received an average scholarliness score of 14. And then if you found it in both, which is that purple bar, it received an average scholarliness score of 14.2. And then the exclusivity measure that I talked a little bit about before. This was kind of an interesting graph for us to take a look at. You can see the differences between disciplines, but the very first two bars there show the differences in exclusivity. So this yellow bar is basically telling us that 76% of the citations that were available in the library database were available in Google Scholar, compared to this blue bar that tells us that only 47% of Google Scholar citations were available in library databases. So basically, if you take those two charts, basically what this is telling us is that using Google Scholar, you're more likely to find scholarly resources that have a higher scholarly score, and you're likely to find almost all of the same content. 76% of the content, you'll have already discovered it just by using Google Scholar. So perhaps Google Scholar is a great place to start your research. You're going to find scholarly materials, and you're going to find things, most of the content that's already available in library databases for most disciplines. So after we conducted our study, there were several areas that we wanted to maybe take a look at in the future, and I want to talk about maybe some of the weaknesses of the studies that may need some improvement as we go forward. The first thing is that these results are not generally applicable. It cannot be extrapolated to a larger population. So our results were specific to the librarians that we used and to the subjects that we chose to take a look at. Not even just the subjects, but the specific topics that we researched. A more robust statistical methodology would need to be used to make the results more generally applicable. However, I will say that we were very encouraged by the results that we saw. The statistical significance was very high on some of these. So we feel that the results would hold up if we extrapolated, but statistically, strictly speaking, we're not able to do that using the methodology that we use. So another methodology would need to be employed. The other thing we'd like to do in the future is to improve the rubric. We were able to identify statistically significant differences between things, specifically between Google Scholar results and database results, and that there were no differences between disciplines. But the variance was difficult for us to measure. And that's because of the rubric that we used. We used a scale of between 1 and 3, which doesn't leave much wiggle room. What we would want to do in the future is to use a rubric with a Likert scale of maybe 1 to 7 or 1 to 10, and that would allow us to identify more of the variance there. It would allow for basically for more nuanced statistical analysis and make it easier to spot the differences. The other thing that we'd want to take a look at is perhaps the scholarliness calculation. We liked the calculation that we used. However, in the end, it really was just a subjective opinion of our subject experts. There are lots and lots of different ways that you can use to create a scholarliness score. We happen to use that rubric based on previous research, but you could also argue that maybe citation counts or impact factors may be a better, more objective measure of scholarliness. The problem with that is that Google Scholar returns a wide range of results. Citation counts and impact factors are largely only assigned to journal articles, but Google Scholar returns things from books, conference reports, even sometimes from professors' syllabi, interestingly enough. So what the best measure of scholarliness is still kind of up in the air. Perhaps a better measure could be come up with than the one we used. The other thing we'd like to maybe take a look at in the future was to maybe compare Google Scholar to a federated search. So we compared Google Scholar to an individual library. It may be a more fair comparison to compare Google Scholar to a wide range of library databases. So basically, that was our research. And any questions?
My name is Evan Froot from University Library in Trondheim. I got one question. Those 30 citations from the library database, how were they sorted? Because usually the default sorting is by date, and that wouldn't give anything relevant, I think. So did it some extra sorting criteria that I put there? Or?
That's a very good question. What we've tried to do at our library is to change the defaults of our library databases to sort by relevance rather than by date. So for the EBSCO databases and some of those others, they allowed for us to make that change. So for some of the library databases, they sorted by date. For most of them, I think about 3/4 of them were sorted by relevance, according to the way the library databases are able to sort by relevance. So that is a fair question. That does make it very difficult for library databases to compete against Google Scholar, which always sorts by default by relevance. But we tried to account for that as best we could.
My name is Paul Lycha. I'm an academic librarian at the University Library of Oslo. I saw that you said that access was more important than ownership.
Yes.
But I agree. I don't care about ownership as long as I have very good access. But there's bad access and very good access.
Sure.
So, for example, in Norway we have an encyclopedia, the big Norwegian encyclopedia, mm-hmm. and we bought access to them before. But now they are perhaps stop production, so the access can be disappear.
Sure.
Open access in Sweden, we have the Directory of Open Access Journals, and they are secured for eternity through the certified portico. That is good access. Then I don't need to own it.
Right.
So I just want to say that it's good access and bad access, and you have to look at, sometimes you need ownership or you have to work for open access. Yeah.
Sure. I think that's a very interesting point. There has to be a balance there. I'm not saying that access is everything. You have to just have access. You don't need to own anything. Certainly there are some things that you need to own. For example, at my institution, we are a church-owned school, so it's important for us to collect some of the church materials. For us, access is not good enough for that. We have to have ownership of that. We can't risk losing that. We collect heavily in Western Americana, so for some of those types of things, it's very important for us to own. But there are some other materials, like perhaps the New England sheep herder, that for us, we don't really collect in that area. There's perhaps one faculty member on campus who would like to have access to that. For us, bad access is good enough, even in that case. And that's the problem, is to try and evaluate when is access good enough and when do we really need to have ownership. And that's the question we need to be asking ourselves, I think.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you. It was a very inspirational talk, and particularly in terms of challenging the assumptions that you mentioned at the beginning of the talk. Mm. I look forward to go back to my librarians in the UK and challenge their assumptions about Google, Google Scholar, and how much it can, you know, it's how valued it is in relation to the traditional databases. Just a very quick question, and perhaps I didn't quite get the nuances of the statistical analysis, but when you're talking about the results from Google Scholars, some overlapped with the databases. Mm-hmm. What I'm not quite sure is how then you, if there was any overlap, then the overall number of articles, of hits, sources retrieved, wouldn't add up to 60, would it?
In some cases, it wouldn't. For example, some of the search terms were so specific that the library databases only returned like 24 results,
right,
or 15 results. So we tried to get to 30, but if we couldn't, that was fine.
Right. Did that have any effect on the statistical analysis of it?
It didn't. It was a large enough sample size that we were able to address all of that. So we still feel pretty good about the numbers, even if we didn't get quite up to 30 in each resource.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
So yeah, that's our statistical guru who assures me he has years and years of experience in the field. So that it is, they're good numbers.
Good enough answer.
Yes.
I think.
My name is Svein Engstad from the University of Oslo. there was a question here about the amount of answers from the different databases, and I've seen that there are a huge amount of answers from the Google Scholar, but rather few from the databases. But that's a bit awkward often, because you don't get the answers that you are looking for in Google Scholar. Compared with the library databases that you are searching in. Do you have any comment to that?
So this is basically a question about the number of results in Google Scholar. You obviously, when you do a search in Google Scholar, you sometimes come up with hundreds of thousands of results. What our study found is that most people don't go beyond the first three pages, and the first three pages are very relevant, very targeted results. And in fact, those first 30 on average are much more scholarly than even the ones that you find in the library databases. So even though Google Scholar is casting a wider net and receiving a large number of results, most people ignore all of the results and just concentrate on the first page. I think 75% of people just look at the first page of results even. So not very many people go onto the second page, and even fewer go onto the third page, and virtually no one goes beyond that. And so basically you have self-selecting in that that patrons don't go beyond the first three pages, and those first three pages are very relevant. So even if you get a large number, you still have very relevant results.
How do you define the relevance in the Google Scholar results when you get 5,000 answers and you're looking for some specific thing? I've tried to do some search by myself, but not scientifically, mm-hmm, way like this, but I've been rather confused by the huge number, and I haven't found what I was looking for, which I could find in the specialized databases. Sure. So I was trying to do this when I should renew my databases last year. So I couldn't find that it was good enough at all.
Yeah, and that's a fair question. That's a fair criticism, I think, of Google Scholar. For the purposes of this study, the way we defined relevance in Google Scholar was however the librarians defined relevance. You'll remember that the rubric that we had them use, one of the six categories was relevance. So if they told us that the article was relevant, we said, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, that's relevant. And so we took their word for it. We used them as the experts. So we didn't look specifically at the relevance, and that would be an interesting study to take a look at that and see what problems there may be by casting that larger net.
My name is Ellen Nierenberg from Hedmark University College. I'm interested in knowing if you compared the amount of full text available in the two.
That's a good question. We did. The researcher that I worked with, one of them anyway, Rebecca Bowen, she took a close look at that. There was actually, Google Scholar, unless it's open access, contains virtually no full text. However, we've worked with Google Scholar. We have our electronic collections showing up there. So we have basically a direct link from Google Scholar to our full text. So actually more full text was available to us because we've worked with them in Google Scholar than what was in some of the library databases. But I don't have the exact numbers for you. But if you want to email me, I can get them to you.
Arne Jacobsson from Oslo University Library. I'm having a medical doctor writing a PhD. Can I tell him it's enough to search in Google Scholar, or must he also search in Medline?
That's an interesting question. Google Scholar actually goes out and indexes Medline. I don't know how frequently that they do so. They're usually a week or two behind. So, I like anything, there's no, just do that and you're good enough. Like anything in the library world, it's a wonderful place to start. You're going to get the bulk of your resources there. You'll discover some things serendipitously that perhaps you would not have discovered otherwise. But in addition to searching Google Scholar, you should also search Medline and the other resources. I'm a Google Scholar advocate, but not that much.
Evan Flood again. You made a comment that made me jump a couple of meters here. You said that a Google Scholar does not have full text. It does index the full text. When you search Google Scholar, you search the full text. That's a huge difference between the library databases. In the library databases, you only search for abstracts, keywords, title. In mm-hmm. Google Scholar, you search the full text. That can be a huge difference. I've done searching in Scopus and ISI, which gives 10 to 15 citations, and in Google Scholar gives 1,900. Because the terms I had was in the full text and not in those keywords. So that's a very important difference between those databases.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Google Scholar does index it if it's open access, if the publisher has agreed to allow for that type of indexing. For example, JSTOR and Cambridge University and several other presses, I believe Oxford, work closely with Google Scholar and allow them to index the full text.
Elsevier got in the act at 207. 27, and they saw that the number of downloads increased dramatically when they did that, because people searched Google Scholar and then downloaded the whole article. But the point is, the full text is there, and that's a big advantage to ISI and Scopus, which I compare with.
Yes, for discovery, the full text is there, but for access, that's still where libraries need to step in. Yeah, and so that's where I say that Google Scholar has decoupled access and discovery. Before, if you wanted to discover materials, you had to go to the library, go to a library database and search for it and then get access. Here in Google Scholar, you can search Google Scholar, you can discover content in Google Scholar, but you still need to rely on the libraries to give you access to most of that content.
My name is Sigrid Gimse, and I'm from Norwegian School of Management. And do you still see that as a future going to last into the future as well, that you have to rely, there will still be libraries controlling this access, that you can find things in these open search engines, but you still have to rely on the library to get them?
That's a good question. My background is actually in economics. That's why I studied as an undergraduate. And this information, all of it has value. And as long as that information has value, somebody's going to be able to find a way to make money off of it. And most people aren't willing to pay for it, but libraries are, because we know how valuable it is. So I think even in the future, libraries, I really feel like that is our mission, is to provide access to that content. I don't see that changing anytime soon. Google is very good at helping you discover content and pointing you to places where you can get access. But even with the Google Book Project, they still point you to the publisher's site, they point you to libraries, they point you to different places to get access. They're not necessarily, unless it's out of copyright, providing access to the actual content. I think that is librarians' strength.
I talked to a news journalist from a Norwegian commercial broadcasting, TV2, before the weekend, and he talked about a service in the US, which is called Umu or something, in which there was a company or a service where you could actually subscribe to all your favorite serials or TV series in the broadcasting networks, and then you can have them on your computer, independent of when they were broadcasted, and you can have them before they were broadcasted. And he saw that as a brilliant business model, but alas, he saw that as the beginning or the he saw that as the beginning of the decline of commercial broadcasting as we know it.
Did you say the service was Hulu or?
Yeah, Hulu. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, Hulu. I use that all the time. It's a great service, but I don't think it's necessarily the end of broadcasting, because the way that they make money on these broadcasts is with the commercials that are shown in between throughout the show. Hulu is still broadcasting commercials in between. So they're getting money both ways, for the Hulu content and for the things that they broadcast on TV. The problem is with the Nielsen ratings that were briefly mentioned by Alex Bloomberg here. They don't account for viewing on Hulu and online views of the content. And that's how advertising rates are set in the United States, is by the Nielsen ratings. And so the Nielsen ratings are starting to account for these online views. And as long as they continue to make progress in that way, I think Hulu is actually a great model for the future, and they'll still be able to make money off of it if they do it right.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Jared, so much. And if anyone now wants to go back and read Jared's report, well, just Google it. Thank you for coming. Jared made an wonderfully swift reply to my first email and said, would you like to come to Norway? And he says, yes. We enjoyed that very much. As an extremely small token for our appreciations, we would like to give you some chocolate from Arctic Lapland.
Oh, wow.
Everything locally produced except for the cocoa beans, I think.
Thank you very much. Thank you.